This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Swings here and he drives one deep into center. Puig is racing back, still going back. He looks up. It's gone! Over the center field wall for Hunter Pence. Pence will touch them all and score them all. A grand slam for Hunter Pence.
It's not easy when it's tough. That's when you find out what you're made of.
You get so much Brisby in your ears if you want it. If you want Brisby, oh gosh, you get it.
Anybody want coffee? I'm making coffee. Anybody want?
Yes! Yes! Yes!
I'm a frequent coffee drinker. I'm part of the club. I have a card.
You're listening to The Baseball Barista with Hunter Pence and Grant Brisby on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 12 of The Baseball Barista with Hunter Pence and Grant Brisby, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Hunter, how are you doing today?
Grant, I'm doing excellent. So happy to be here for The Baseball Barista, sipping on my coffee. So many great things going on in this baseball season. This is a wild one. And I'm just thrilled to be here talking baseball with you. Great things going on.
You know, real quick, since I'm mentioning Topps, did you collect baseball cards when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Mainly for the bubblegum, though, back in the day.
And so when you're holding your very first baseball card, did you just stare at it for a while? Because I feel like I would just stare at it for an hour.
Like, I remember just being happy to open up the packs and so pumped to get the bubblegum. That's like... That's my memory of, and like, it was like, the other thing was, is like, run down the foul balls and take them to the concession stand to get like you could get a soda, because we didn't have sodas, you know, at our house. So I was always so like in a rush to get any foul ball.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Now I remember like when the rare occasion where my mom or dad would get me a box of baseball cards from like Costco or Price Club back then, that's when the gum really became an issue, because now you're shoving, you know, 20 in your mouth at one time. And good memories. And crunchy gum, I don't know. I have a soft spot for crunchy gum.
You get the big bubbles out of that stuff too, you know? I don't think I ever had 20, but that sounds like a good time. What was your favorite card as a kid?
Favorite card? You know, it was Ricky Henderson. It was a Granny Goose card. It was a card that had like a little scratch-off contest. And you would scratch off the contest to see if you won. But if you didn't scratch it off, it was worth more, right? This is back when baseball cards had heightened value. And why it's my favorite is because I took it to Ricky Henderson to sign at a card show. And he said, you know what? Don't scratch this. Ricky's card is worth a lot more if you don't scratch this off. And it was like, oh man, of course I'm not going to scratch it off, Ricky. So that makes it my favorite old-time baseball card.
Dang, that's so cool. I used to love the batting gloves that he had, that he ran with, that had like the Mizuno little pumps. Those were so sweet.
The fluorescent green.
The fluorescent green, but they had the little pads. I thought they were so cool.
You know, whenever I'd get on first base, I had those gloves and I would go into the crouch and I run, you know, like a two-legged raccoon. I was not fast, but I had the gloves, so I had to pretend that I was fast. So good times, good times.
You know what else is fun about Little League? That, like, at least back then and our time, and we didn't have, you know, as much coverage as we do now. We didn't have YouTube and all of the cool games, but it was super fun to like imitate, like you said, like the Ricky Henderson stance and the sprinting. But it was also super fun. Like, we would do everyone's batting stance, from like Julio Franco to like, I remember trying to be Bo Jackson, and like the way you did Bo Jackson. I don't know if you remember this. Can you remember Bo Jackson's stance? Did you ever try to do it as a kid?
Bo Jackson, I don't. Like, Julio Franco, absolutely. Bo Jackson, I don't. Not off the top of my head. I mean, I can kind of picture it.
So I just remember going to my Little League games. And this is when I'm like 6 or 7 or something, and just like completely straightening my front foot. So it's like this like barred out front foot leg, because it just felt like that's what Bo Jackson did. So I was like Bo Jackson at the plate. Anyway, just good memories. You brought up good memories. So we can carry on to the stuff and things you want to talk about, Big Grant.
See, sometimes the tangents are just the best part. But we're going to talk about, I hope this is okay with you, baseball. We're going to talk about some of the best players around baseball. We're going to talk about who is, I don't know if we're going to frame it as like who's in the lead for the MVP, because it is still June, but let's just talk about the players having goofy seasons. You know, just like if a player has caught your eye and you're like, man, this guy is doing some good stuff, let's talk about it, because it's a way to celebrate baseball. You know, all the news about baseball is kind of bleak, you know, if you're chasing down the hot takes and stuff like that. So let's talk about the players who are doing good stuff. Anyone catch your eye?
Well, I mean, obviously there's some tremendously wild things. And one of my, I have a couple of thoughts on that. I can't just answer it straight away, but I'm going to start with one of my favorite things to follow in all of baseball has always been the Triple Crown. The Triple Crown is just like such just an absolute dominance. And, you know, I think Miguel Cabrera was the last one to win the Triple Crown in 2012, if I recall right. But Vladimir Guerrero leading the Triple Crown numbers, I know it's early, but I mean, Vladdy Guerrero, he put on some great offensive program, workout program, offseason workout program. He's moving around, bouncing around, making good defensive plays. His speed right now, like, which is kind of crazy, is above league average. So he really put in that work, and now you're seeing the talent. He's only 22. You know, I think Vladimir Guerrero has to be, you know, at the top of the list of like players just doing absurd things anytime you're talking Triple Crown.
You know, basically the age of a college senior. I mean, you forget how young Guerrero is, because it feels like we've been waiting for him to become the baseball player he's become. At the same time, like, it's the way he's doing it. It's not just he's bopping home runs. It's not just that he's hitting for a high average. It's like, how do you pitch to him? He is like the most dangerous batter in baseball almost, because he has such command of the strike zone. He's able to make great contact, and he's just doing damage on pitches anywhere in the strike zone. It's phenomenal.
I think adding the patience to it is something you didn't expect from this young. Like, you knew, like, when you think of like Vladimir Guerrero, you think of the guy who can like hit a double off a ball bouncing. Like, he's just got like crazy hand-eye coordination, his dad, and like swung at everything. And the fact that Vlad Jr., not only is he like power and crazy, able to hit a lot of pitches and put up good at bats, but like when you add patience and taking a walk to the mix, it just becomes this like unheard of, you know, hitter. I don't want to go into Barry Bonds just yet, but I mean, how many walks did Barry Bonds have? Like, so, you know, he has a long way to go. And if we're starting here at 22, chasing a Triple Crown, we have a lot of exciting things to look forward to. But the other thing that's crazy to me, not only is it like the power, the great hand-eye coordination, the not like low whiff percentage, and like his barrel percentage, his hard hit percentage is like absurd. But then you're adding what I didn't expect when I was like, yeah, he's going to be like his dad. He's going to crush. He's going to hit. It's going to be exciting. But he's also fast and athletic. Like, that to me is like the whole package. It's like, yeah, he's this offensive threat, but he's also making great defensive plays. He's getting down the line. That's extraordinarily exciting for me.
It's funny, because now that you're saying all this, it's making me think of a potential future where, like, 30 years, we're talking about Pablo Sandoval Jr. having like great walk rates and like the discipline of Pablo Sandoval Jr. Because that's what it's like to talk about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. You're just used to Vladimir Guerrero meaning one thing, which is a very unique hitter. It's athleticism. It's just like this raw, you know, statue, but fast with the arm of the gods. And, you know, he'll hit the ball that bounces on the plate and he'll hit it over the fence. Like, that's what Vladimir Guerrero means in my mind. And to have like, oh no, now it means something a little bit different. It's a different kind of athleticism. It's a different kind of hitter. It's still just as unique, and like the statue body is a different kind of statue body. It's just like he's such a unique player. It's like impossible to have two players who are so unique with the same name. I don't know. It's in very different ways.
But I think it's also fun, you know, like that you're following like the son of someone, you know, a lot of people, like, you felt Vlad Sr. when he played, you felt his joy and his passion and his love for hitting. Like, you just think of baseball. There's pine tar over the helmet, pine tar all over the bat. You know, this dirty guy that's got this great rhythm and gives you just a heck of an at-bat and was involved in a lot of, you know, great runs and just baseball tradition. And you can tell, you can feel the love from the son as well. And it's a little bit different story. So it's like, it's fun because you feel like they're part of your family. You know, when you're in the baseball family and you're a fan, you follow it. Like, you just, you have great memories of Vladimir Guerrero. And like being in awe of how he hit. And now we're watching, you know, like the home run derby, even though Vlad Jr. lost it a couple years back, that home run derby that he put up in 2019, where he hit like 20 some homers and he's just flicking them out at 21 years old or 20 years old, whatever he was. I think it might have been 2 years ago. It's incredible. It's a part of the story of baseball and the fabric of the fun. And he's got kind of just that smile, that playfulness, and that youthfulness, and it's just a joy to watch right now.
One reason I like talking about him is because years ago I wrote a series on where home runs look the best. And I looked at all 30 major league ballparks and like, where do home runs look the best? I mean, a home run's a home run, it goes over the fence. But a home run that sails over this fence looks a little bit different than a home run that sails over this fence. And he hit two home runs last week over the Green Monster. And that was my number one. That's my favorite kind of home run, is that right-handed, just crushing a ball into the night. And like, where does it go? I don't know. It's just gone. It's just, you know, forget it. That baseball's dead. And I love the way an absolutely crushed right-handed home run looks in Fenway Park. And he had a couple just beauties. And I just love the aesthetics of it.
You know, I feel like he's just hitting them so far. It's incredible. Like, to me, Boston isn't that, but it's because I looked at it through a different scope. Like, because I'm like, I want to see where it actually lands. Like, I want to be able to judge that homer versus that homer. And when they just, like, Boston's field is so small that when they go, like, flying out of the stadium over and over again, you're like, well, I don't know how far that went compared to so-and-so home run I saw back in the day, right? So then the legend disappears. When Vlad's hitting these homers, I want to see how far they go so I can compare them to all the other homers, because that becomes, it becomes, like, part of the story. So, like, that's why I'm, like, I love Boston and I love the Green Monster. I love the history there, but I don't like seeing the homers that are crushed there, because, you know, I want to see them, like, how far up does it go in New York or Arizona? Like, did you get to the third row in the Mets or even Milwaukee? I once saw, oh man, I can't remember the name of this. I saw a left-handed hitter hit one up into like this little deck that I didn't even know was like possible to get to. It's like a fourth or fifth deck. Like, it was the farthest home run I've ever seen. So that's the only reason that I'm a little bit sad when he blasts one and you don't get to see how far did it really go.
See, I guess the compromise would be Houston, because you have, like, you can generally see where the home runs land there, but then you get that extra special, like Tatis had one earlier this year where it just disappears. But for the most part, you kind of see where it lands. I know Pujols had the famous one off of Brad Lidge. You know, I just love, like, the backdrop of a high, high target. But when the ball clears that high target and goes extra far, I don't know, there's something, it's like a bonus home run to me.
The bonus. Yeah, I just, like I said, I like seeing, and even like Houston, it is really fun to watch that, like, because like it's going on to the train tracks, which is cool. But you still like miss out on some of those extra gnarly home runs where you're like, where the hell did it go? It, like, because like they could hit the glass at the back of the stadium, which sometimes they do. They could bounce on the track. But you want to be able to see, like, where did it actually go?
That kind of leads into one of my favorite all-time in-person home runs, which was the 2017 World Series. I was in center field in the auxiliary press box when Carlos Correa, this is game, what was it, 5, just the bonkers back and forth, Astros and Dodgers. And Carlos Correa hit a ball. And where it landed was where the pyrotechnics shot off. So it looked like the ball caused the explosion. And I think that's like the best of both worlds. It was so perfectly timed. And I think it was accidental. And just, he hits the home run, it lands, and boom, like a cannon went off. Yeah, that was a great one.
I mean, that's exciting. True story, though, is there's legends of McGuire like hitting the lights in Houston. And we brought out like a aluminum bat to play around with on like a off day hitting BP, and with aluminum bats we could get them to the lights. But the fact that Mark McGuire was putting them to the lights was always the legend.
Now tell me a little bit about that. So aluminum bats, you occasionally you'd mess around with aluminum bats in batting practice?
I did it one time in Philly and one time in Houston, and then I was like, this is dangerous because the balls were going. And then also, it messed with my mind a little bit because then I got my wooden bat out, and I would hit it really hard and really far, and it would just seem not that far because you're like leaving both stadiums and hitting the lights with the aluminum, and then just like, it feels really dull, and I didn't like the sense that it made me sad with my wooden bat.
As a kid, I watched This Week in Baseball, that show with Mel Allen, and they had an April Fool's joke where they sat with pitchers and they asked them for an interview and they said, okay, so I've just breaking the news to you. They're going to start using aluminum bats in the major leagues. Can we get your reaction on camera? And, you know, about half the pitchers didn't pick up that it was an April Fool's joke. And they weren't happy. You know, even in the 80s, they were just like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm going to take a screen out there. They were so livid and mad. I still can't believe they used them for so long in college baseball.
They still use aluminum in college baseball, right?
Aren't they like composite something?
Yeah, I think they definitely like have deadened them. So it's like, it's actually like almost harder to hit with those bats than it is with wooden bats. But I don't know, like it's always changing. So who knows exactly, but I'm pretty sure they weakened them a ton.
All right, well, let's move on to one of the pitchers, someone who's caught my eye, just because it feels like it's taken him a long time to get here. This is Zach Wheeler, and he's someone of special fascination to me because the Giants traded him for Carlos Beltran in 2011. And it felt like the Mets were, you know, they would get a year and then he'd get hurt and then he'd come back and his command was off. And then, you know, right as he was coming into his own, he leaves in free agency and then he goes to the Phillies. And then there's a pandemic and he can't really see, you know, him coming into his own that much. He had 11 starts last year. He's a monster now. He's 31 years old. He is leading the league in innings pitched. He has the lowest FIP in baseball. He's got a 2.29 ERA as of this recording. He is a nasty, nasty pitcher coming into his own. And I feel like the Phillies sort of like not gambled because he was already a really good pitcher, but paid for this kind of pitcher. They didn't pay for someone who would put up an ERA close to four. They paid for this. And I think that their faith was rewarded.
Yeah, I mean, this is an extraordinary season. He's an extraordinary talent. When he's healthy and as he's like hitting his prime, I mean, he's just got overpowering stuff. And the thing that's super cool about Wheeler is, you know, he came up young and he was, you know, you would expect like the 95, and that's kind of what you heard when he was like the prospect. But he just continued to elevate his velocity. And like, that's kind of rare, especially in like professional baseball, to jump higher in velocity because you're throwing so much. And like, Zach Wheeler's been like a, you know, he's in the rotation every year, just eating up innings. So to be pitching that many innings and to be going up in velocity says a lot about your talent and your work ethic and your discipline. You know, once he got command of everything, this is what you're seeing. I'm not sure what his velo is now, but I know that he was touching 98 and just like overpowering stuff. You know, a fastball slider, he could just beat you with that because it was so explosive. But if he added any other pitches, I haven't gotten to see him pitch this year, though. What's he featuring?
He is kind of, you know, the fastball. He's got the slider. He's the pitcher, kind of like you're saying, you know, when he came up, he had the raw stuff. And the more innings you pitch, you know, you get smarter as a starting pitcher, but you also, it's wear and tear, and you maybe lose a little tick off your fastball. But he hasn't lost a tick. It's mainly, let's see, he's got a fastball that's up to 97 average velocity, which is the highest of his career.
That's average velocity. That's insane. So he's probably pumping 99s on the regular.
Yeah, he's throwing the fastball. It looks like 62% of the time. Slider, 25. He'll mix in a curve and a changeup, but it's mostly just that hot fastball with good command and the slider to finish you off.
And that's enough when your average fastball is 97. So, and I'm sure he's got where he's digging back in the tank when he needs it. You know, when they get to that veteran status and they understand the rhythms of the game, they dig deep when they need it and they, you know, cruise when they need to cruise. So that's a really, really, you know, exciting season for Zach Wheeler. And like you said, what the Phillies paid for. But I think the year that he had with the Mets, like they had that, you know, Wheeler was, you know, arguably behind DeGrom, who is another one in that division that's having one of the most spectacular seasons of all time. But they had DeGrom, Wheeler, Syndergaard, and like, you know, he was kind of the number two, like the best as far as like numbers in his final season with the Mets. So this is kind of what you expected for sure from him.
You know, I mentioned that Wheeler led the league in FIP, which is sort of like ERA, but that's because I forgot to turn off the innings qualifier because DeGrom, let's start talking about him again, because just because he doesn't qualify for the ERA title yet, he's missed a couple starts. His season, as of right now, 0.56 ERA. If he keeps that up, I mean, I always used to just stare at like the Bob Gibson in the Baseball Encyclopedia where he had the 1.12 ERA. It's an ERA from 1968 that I can remember because it was so freaky. And if DeGrom, you know, keeps it up, 0.56, if he doubles that, he's in Bob Gibson territory. He's just having a goofy, goofy year.
I wouldn't say goofy. I mean, I would say dominant. Like that, yeah. The DeGrominant, I know it's like been said too much, but it literally is just dominant. And I was reading this article and it was talking about like, you know, how good he's done and like what as a hitter do you do to approach someone that's this good? And apparently the best approach against DeGrom is to not swing. When that's like what the articles are writing, is like your best approach against him is to not swing because the whiff percentage, the hit percentage is so low. And by the way, your best approach is to not swing and he has a 4% walk rate. So good luck.
So just go up there like Santiago Casilla and just, you know, stand 5 feet off the plate and just hold the bat up and take your takes?
I would do more like movement and wiggling, try to get in his head a little bit, you know, like maybe even get close to the plate and hope that one can hit you, you know, if you're willing to take 102 off the ribs for the team, you know. But I mean, I think the article beyond just like your best approaches to not swing was saying that once you get to two strikes, a lot of times he's throwing stuff. It's like the lowest percentage in the zone with two strikes, but batters are swinging at it at a high rate. It's 60.5% of the time it's out of the zone and hitters are flailing at it. Wait, let me read this exactly. Hitters are flailing against pitches that aren't even strikes anyway. 65% of the time DeGrom is throwing the hitter a ball. Yeah, that's with two strikes. So, and hitters are swinging at it a lot. So he's obviously throwing that strike to ball slider, and you have to respect the fastball. So that's what makes it so tough. So I think your best bet with DeGrom and the reason not to swing is to work his pitch count up as high as you can and try to get him out of there so you can get to their pen. But once you get to the Mets pen, guess what? That's nasty too.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB show.
We were laughing about Wheeler's average fastball velocity with DeGrom. Average fastball velocity 99.2. So, I mean, that is that's closer. And it's not just like closer stuff. That's like elite closer stuff. That's the closer you talk about 20 years later to be able to pump an average fastball of 99. For a starting pitcher, outlawed.
Honestly, this is the crazy thing is that like miles per hour doesn't give you the whole story because I don't know how to explain it, but like it just comes out of different pitchers' hands differently. And maybe it's like some of them are getting closer to you. And like think of how tall DeGrom is and his extension. Where is he releasing that 99, that 100, 101, 102? When he first came up, once again, you know, he was like 95, 97, you know, 94 a lot of the times. And it was like this explosive 94 to 97. So his ball like rises as far as like the way you see it mentally. So it appears to be in one place, but it's above that by a lot. So it's already it's a really tricky, deceptive pitch because it just explodes up. And so the fact that he's increased his velocity this high, and then he's really commanding that slider so that you have to respect the fastball away, and it's just like, oh, guess what? This is a slider away, and it's a ball, and you're not going to hit it. So it's truly going to be exciting to follow the rest of his season. We definitely hope he stays healthy, and we get to watch what he's doing because, like you said, it's Bob Gibson dominance, it's DeGrominance, and it is something special where if you got a chance to go watch this guy pitch right now, you need to go watch him because it's as good as it's ever been.
Now, this is a good point. I'm glad that you brought that up about, you know, velocity not always being the full story, because take a guy like Richard Rodriguez, the closer for the Pirates. He throws a fastball that's like 92, 93. He throws it about 90% of the time. He is a fastball forward pitcher, and it's not the hottest velocity, but even when you have an idea that it's coming, hitters just aren't picking it up out of his hand. So you have that aspect to a fastball. That can make a great fastball even without velocity. Then you have guys who can maybe pump it up into triple digits, but hitters can see it out of their hands. And, you know, maybe they're able to get more contact on it than you would think based on the radar gun. What DeGrom does is he takes that funky, the fastball that would work in the low 90s, and he pairs it with the high velocity. And now you have a fastball that would work at a much lower velocity. Oh, but now it's triple digits too. So it's like he's exponentially better.
There's all sorts of different things that make fastballs seem and appear in different ways. And like you said, like sometimes, you know, certain pitchers like open up. A lot of times like sinker pitchers will do that and they'll just like show it to you for a long time. So you'll get like a good view of it. Even though it's really hard, you have a lot of time seeing it. And the ones that can really hide it, and so like the ball releases like from their body or like have different angles. This is where like a lot of people ask me some of the nastiest pitchers I've ever faced. And the two that I bring up is Arrieta had a window in like 2 years where it was like he had kind of a 1.75 or a 0.75, like something super low. And that was when they won the World Series and they were going super deep. But he would step across his body. And then, like, he had a cutter and he had a turbo sinker from stepping across his body. So it was, like, kind of coming from behind your neck. And it was either going to keep coming at your face or be, like, this huge slider. But the ball, even his fastball, it, because he stepped across his body, imagine it coming. The ball started going, like, kind of at an angle towards the outside corner. But then it would, like, take, like, a right turn. So it was kind of, it was just, like, it felt like it had three different directions. So, like, it was super circus pitch. And then also it could be the cutter that just keeps going that same direction. So it was a really tough window to face him. And then also when Lincecum was throwing 101 and he was doing the same thing, like, the wraparound thing that he did. And it was just, like, coming from this, like, crazy angle. And he's the only right-handed pitcher that threw me a left-handed curveball. Somehow his split finger broke because he was throwing so hard with so much torque. His splitty or his changeup, I don't know what you want to call it, it broke as sharp as a left-handed curveball, like slider. So imagine a lefty like spinning a ball as hard as they can and it just diving down and into you. He threw a changeup that had that same bite, and that's how explosive Lincecum was. So those were the two. But anyway, I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but I was just thinking, and this is kind of where DeGrom is right now, is he's hiding the ball, it's exploding, it's rising, and you're going to have to make a tremendous guess to hit him correctly right now.
Was there a pitcher who like offered close to or maybe triple digit velocity that you just saw really well for whatever reason? You couldn't explain it. Maybe no one else saw it as well, but you just happened to see it well?
In the younger years, like Eovaldi, you could kind of see pretty good for how hard he was throwing, you know, and I think Belt always hit him pretty well. But he had some good starts against us for sure. We seemed to hit him better at his place. I'm trying to think of some other people throwing 100 that you just kind of saw okay. But that was the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah, no, you bringing up Lincecum, it reminds me of just how different baseball is now. And I don't just mean how the sport is played, but how accessible every granular scrap of video is now. I can watch every pitch. I can pull up every pitch thrown in the 2021 season and analyze it. If I want to go back and watch Tim Lincecum when he was, you know, throwing upper 90s, maybe 100 every so often, it's hard to find that video. Like, you really have to search. You'll get selected starts or selected highlights, but it's not the same. Like, I want to just watch hours of Tim Lincecum video. And it's just, that's not how baseball was back in 2007, 8, 9. It's just, it wasn't that accessible.
Yeah, it's definitely sad. And that's what I was talking about when we were kids. Like, there was no YouTube, there was no MLB Network. A lot of these like great opportunities to like learn from the best. So like baseball knowledge was like kind of like secretive back then. Like, Everyone was keeping secrets because you could. But now, you know, we're in the information age where, you know, everyone's promoting their, you know, whatever, their social media and all of that, which is understood, and everyone's sharing knowledge. And so all the secrets and all the information's out there. If you want to do the work, you can hear from the best hitters everywhere. You can find everything. But it is a little sad because I would love to go back and watch some of Lincecum's like crazy starts when he first came up, and, you know, even the 2010 run. I remember playing against the 2010 Giants and just being like, man, it was a beast to come into San Francisco. And like, no one, like, they weren't expected to be this great team, but like, you come in and it was Kane pumping like, you know, 95, 96. And that was before, like, that was even common. Like, that was very rare. So you got Lincecum throwing 101. Then you got Sanchez throwing 97. And then you got Affelt throwing 97 out of the pen. And then you run into Casilla throwing 97 out of the pen. You run into Wilson throwing 99 as the closer. It was just like, you were like, buckle up as a hitter when you come to San Francisco. And oh, by the way, the wind's flying in.
And then all of a sudden they bring up some teenager named Madison Bumgarner. Like, oh, how's this going to work out? And they were nasty back then.
Bumgarner I didn't face back then, or I didn't see him. But I just remember I got to do like an interview. And like when the Phillies were the hot team right then, and they were playing the Giants. And I actually picked the Giants to win that series, and they couldn't believe it. And I was like, this pitching that the Giants have, like, you don't, might not know about it now, but step in the box against them. It's you better pack a lunch.
All right. Well, stepping in the box, that's a good segue, because we're going to talk about something that you have thoughts on, and I'm eager to hear them. Walk-up music. We can talk closer entrance music. We can talk walk-up music for a hitter. So when you were hitting, tell us about your walk-up songs.
Well, the walk-up song, it's not just like, hey, what were your walk-up songs? The walk-up song was like such a fun, it's a fun vibe. It's a fun thing to play with. And, you know, everyone does it differently. And I definitely respect, like, there's certain players that just have one song for their whole career and never change it. And I think one of my favorite stories of all time was listening to the video guy with the Phillies talk about Chase Utley and his walk-up song, Led Zeppelin Cashmere, okay? And he was saying, this guy was like a big rock fan. He's like, it's super cool, like, Utley comes out to this song because, you know, this song is like the masterpiece of Led Zeppelin, one of the master rock bands, and Chase Utley is Philly's masterpiece. He just like thought it was like, he's like, it's perfect. It's exactly how it should be. And just like, I was kind of like, wow, that's super cool, you know? And, you know, you think of like Chipper Jones coming out to Crazy Train, and think of Jim Tomei, or at least I do, coming out to The Beautiful People by Marilyn Manson. And I think Evan Longoria's come out to the same one his whole career as well. So I definitely respect that. Mariano Rivera walkout was a big deal. I like to play with my walk-up song. And like, I remember when we're bringing this up, like some of the people doing like really funny things. And I think Tulowitzki was one that always had some really funny walk-up songs that always made me laugh. And I did bring up the Joey Votto tight pants, got my tight white pants on. But I remember Tulo, just, he was the first one to come out to like Miley Cyrus or something. And then he was also coming out to like R. Kelly, like, I'm a flirt, like, just like feeling on your booty or something like that. Like, I don't remember exactly, but he always came out to some funny, like, kind of, like, I don't know, like, songs that you'd put on, like, in the bedroom or something. And I always got a kick out of that.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
That leads into one of my favorite all-time walk-up songs, which is Michael Morse with Take On Me. You know, it's just like, it's a little out of place. It's not ironic because it's a great song. It's just not what you would anticipate for, you know, a slugger coming up to take his hacks.
Okay, so there's way more to Take On Me, and Michael Morse had an art to the walk-up song. So first off, I felt like Michael Morse was one of the best, like, he was an incredible DJ. Like, he, like, loved 80s, and just, like, you know, freaking Sunday morning 80s ninja, like, gotta have it. And like, he would find like these weird, I don't know where he found them, but these weird like 80s and like EDM mixes and techno like synth 80s. And but he also had like really good, like, he was the one who got us our 2014 like crazy pump up song from some guy I've never heard of. And like, he had like this like crazy hard rap, then he could like, he just had a wide range of like, he could do country, he could do Latin music, he could do everything. But what he was most known for was his like finding these really great 80s and 80s remixes and things. And so what he would talk about, and he was always changing his walk-up songs, and he had some super fun ones. But his whole theory was, he's like, listen, you know, you do your first one, it's like gonna get you pumped up. Your first at bat, you're just like getting into the game, you're feeling out the pitcher. Your second at bat, you know, the game's heating up and going on, you know, and whatever. But your third at bat, he would say, he goes, your third at bat is the core of the game. This is the meat of the game. This is when you need your big at bat, and this is when you bring your A song. And he's like, the one song he never changed was his third at bat was always Take On Me. And if he ever got a big hit, and it was usually, you know, that third at bat's usually in the seventh inning, and that's when the game's, you know, figuring itself out. So I always thought that was super cool that he like talked about, he was like orchestrating his at bat walk-up music and timing it for the third at bat to be the climax of the day.
It is remarkable how much fun a walk-up song or entrance song can be for the fans. Because I remember, like, okay, so back in the day, for whatever reason, I just loved that Brent Main had Shakedown Street as a walk-up song. It's a like a disco Grateful Dead song. It's like, how did he pick that? You know, so I tether certain players, random players, you know, esoteric players with these random songs. Tom Lampkin had Alice in Chains Rooster. But when you would get the right fit of song and player, where it would be like Barry Bonds walking up to the next episode, and like that music and the way it got the crowd going, because this is peak Bonds. This is Bonds at his MVP best, and you would hear that music and the crowd would go bananas. It's hard to explain. It's just like, it's such a special experience for the fans too.
It's a super fun time when you have like a moment like that where like the fans can even like, you know, and even we would, you know, you hear this song and someone's having that great season and you're like feeling that energy of the song that fills the stadium. It really is special when you have like that Barry Bonds, and when Buster was coming out to some country song, and you know, Pablo was always having his like really fun. I remember he was coming out to this was in 2012 where everyone was doing that crazy, the Harlem Shake. Remember Harlem Shake? Whoa, 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 whoa. And like everyone was doing these like wild videos. And so he was coming out to that during 2012. I remember that was like a big thing. And they would like start pumping your music when you got a hit. Like, so you would have it as a walk up. Then if you did like something sweet, they would like pump it again. And I just remember the whole like stadium going nuts when Pablo was hitting these homers and they were pumping the Harlem Shake. And it was like kind of the hot song at the time. And like Gundam Style, Open Gundam Style was a big hit in 2012. So you definitely relate like these songs to the time frame and the season and the run, and it really is a lot of fun whenever you have that whole blend where the song matches the hitter, matches the great season, matches the excitement in the stands.
All right, so let's pretend that a couple of dominoes fell differently in your career. You are not Hunter Pence outfielder, you are Hunter Pence closer, okay? And you're coming in for a save. What is your entrance music? Hunter Pence closer's entrance music.
By the way, I'm already missing one of my favorites was Sergio Romo's when he was with the Giants. Yes. And I didn't know a single word that was being said, but it was always an electric party whenever Romo came out to, I wish I knew the name of it, but it was some just amazing mariachi band like song.
El Machon.
Something about light my fuse is what Romo would say, is that that's talking about. So there's been so many parties and so many great intros, but if you're a closer, you got to have something that lights the crowd up. Like, you know, I really enjoyed like the excitement that you got whenever Romo come out, or, you know, Night Train for Javi Lopez. That was a good one because he was just Jay Smooth. But I think you got to have something that pumps as a closer. And you have to have something, you know, I always liked when they put the lighting system gets involved in it. You know, I think of like, you know, Brad Lidge coming out and like in Houston, whenever he came out, they would like shut the lights off. And then boom, 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 and like fire everywhere, and like something, just like some crazy rock song. I don't remember what it was, but if you're a closer, it's got to be like the Mariano Rivera. It's got to be like something that like gets you super amped, because this is a big moment, and like closers are coming in wild, crazy, and ready to like, this is it. This is the story of the game right here. Once the closer comes in, that's where you get your win. And so for me, it's going to be something super heavy rock, something like lightning bolts. I want fire. I want the lights coming on and off. You know, just be wary. If I'm a closer, I want Psycho.
Yeah, you know, I always said I had two answers. And one was there's a song called Thumb by a band called Caius. And the reason I like that is because it's super heavy, but it builds. It builds. It comes in and it's like it's heavy at the start, but it just keeps getting heavier. So that's one stock answer. But I also thought maybe I'd come out to like Spoonful of Sugar, Mary Poppins, and then throw my first three warm-up pitches to the backstop just to get in the head of the opposing hitter. I don't know. That was the other option.
Listen, you're in the big leagues. Like throwing being a closer and throwing it to the backstop doesn't get in the head, because guess what? We have video of everyone. We know what you throw. We know what you're doing. And if you're just doing that, we have a strategy. So you're not getting in the head of these guys with that or Mary Poppins. I also think of like Valverde. Like this guy like took a ball off the face and kept pitching. And just coming out to just savagery. And I just feel like that's the way. But there are some like super calm. There's some super calm, because a closer is either super intense or hyper calm. Like you think of Rivera, and calm is usually good. I think we brought up another good one. Brian Wilson jump around was pretty good. Gets the fans going. Just anything that gets the fans going gets them excited. And like even though Mariano Rivera came in very ice cold and icy veins and like super focused, his song was pretty pumpy.
Yeah, you had Enter Sandman. That's one of the classics, like Hell's Bells with Trevor Hoffman. That's another classic.
That's it. It's slow. And they did turn the lights off, I think, for him and like turn them on. And it's just like, bong. Like, yeah. Get ready,
that's
get
ominous.
Ready. Bong. Bong, 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 bong. Yeah, it gets you so fired up.
And that has like that same sort of slow burn up. You know, it's not like AC/DC's just coming in, just firing, and they're going at 180 beats per minute. It's just kind of, you know, you got the little ringing guitar, and then it gets heavier, and then it gets heavier. So that's probably, you know, Enter Sandman is a classic, but for me, I think the best of all time is Hell's Bells.
There's no beating Hell's Bells as far as like great, insane intro. There was a couple, like Heath Bell had a decent one for a little bit that always got me pissed off, because it was just like talking about, I forget what it was. They had something like the 300 like clips from movies and stuff. And it was just like something like, I'll beat your ass, like, you know, something like that. And I was just like, I always got super fired up to face him. He was nasty for a little bit too.
It was Blow Me Away by Breaking Benjamin. I did not know that song, but that is funny. Just like that you're paying attention to the lyrics and you're kind of like going, oh, okay, hot shot, let's go.
Yeah. I mean, it's a message. It sends a message.
One of my all-time favorites, and then we'll move on, is because of the timing of it, was Rob Ned's Smoke on the Water.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's a really super heavy riff, one of the classic riffs of all time. They started playing it when the Giants moved into what's now Oracle Park. And so if you grew up a Giants fan and you had your whole experience was Candlestick has a special place in my heart. But when you were there in the new ballpark and you recognized this ballpark is cool, and then your closer's coming in with a song that's heavy, but it also references where you're at, and you're looking around and going, that's right, we're on the water, this is different. Like, it was a perfect marriage of closer stuff, riff, and experience.
Yeah, that, like, sometimes you just get the masterpiece, you know, like the Chase Utley and Philly, and, you know, what Chipper Jones came out to. And Rob Nance was definitely classic. A lot of, like, you know, the 90s, 2000s, like, they got, like, some of that, like, great metal era with, like, Metallica and all these people, and they just, like, you know, and, like, I think Jim told me, the Beautiful People, it's just, like, you feel that. It, like, ramps you up into, like, this Hall of Fame hitter. So I have to also mention, I can't talk walk-up songs without mentioning the last game of the year with Brandon Crawford as shortstop. He's been doing this thing where he like writes everyone's walk-up song, and he has a theme and a purpose behind it, and that's super fun too. So as a Giants fan, I know we've brought up a lot of theirs because we all have kind of connections there, but the last game of the season is super fun to go watch because Brandon puts a lot of thought into it and gives everybody a walk-up song.
He's the clubhouse DJ, right? I mean, that's kind of his role.
Yeah, he's the clubhouse DJ for quite a few years.
That's a lot of pressure. You know, you got a lot of personalities to please, and it seems like he kind of does a good job at it.
It's impossible to please everyone. He does a pretty good job of it. And, you know, it's nice to have that person that you can count on and you can make requests and do those things. So he's a good DJ. It's a tough job, but he's also, that last series is super cool to watch. By the way, sneaky amazing season as well. 15 homers first half, still pumping, playing great defense. So I just wanted a little shout out for Brandon Crawford. And also make sure, Giants fans, you get to that series where he does the walk-ups. Ah, there's so many good ones hitting me. Oh my gosh.
Ah, man, into the ether. You know, before we go, we were sent an article from the New York Times, and we have to cover it because we're the Baseball Barista, and that's a nod to your passion for coffee. I am usually super caffeinated by the time I get on here, too. So we are coffee guys, and the New York Times had an article about how drinking more coffee has health benefits. And so this runs contrary to how I grew up. When I grew up, coffee was going to stunt your growth. It was going to, you know, cause heart problems. But in this one, I'll quote, in a study of more than 200,000 participants followed for up to 30 years, those who drank 3 to 5 cups of coffee a day with or without caffeine were 15% less likely to die early from all causes than were people who shunned coffee. I'm drinking a health thing. This is basically a smoothie.
If you were to tell me that drinking coffee every day makes me die a little bit quicker, I would say I'm still drinking coffee because the time of my life is so much more enjoyable and so much more, you know, fantastic. But it has stimulants and it has great things that like kind of get you moving and get you going. And it's almost like I get worried to say the word spiritual, but it's almost like a spiritual, like my morning and my time with the coffee kind of like preps my day. And now that you're telling me I'm going to get coffee, I'm going to enjoy my day more, and I'm going to live longer. I mean, all the more reason to get involved with the coffee industry. Get out there, check out your local coffee shops. Check out the local roasteries, help these farmers, help these different countries, enjoy the experience because coffee is such a journey. There's so many good coffees out there. There's so many like great farmers. There's so much to learn. It's like, it's just as deep as coffee or as wine, if not more deep. So it's a really fun experience for me. It's a really fun journey and it makes my days better. Now you're telling me it's making me healthier.
I have a weird relationship with coffee in that every so often I will start, I will drink too much of it. I will ramp it up. And then all of a sudden I'm drinking, you know, 6-7 cups a day and it causes heart palpitations, not heart problems. Just, you know, I need to hydrate more. And then I go, you know what? I'm going to take a break from coffee. And then I go to tea. And then I'll go maybe 6 months, a year where I'm drinking tea. And I'm like, oh, I love tea. Tea's so great. And then for whatever reason, I'll take a sip of coffee and go, oh yeah, that's right. This is my true love. I was sort of just pretending tea's cool, but like coffee is coffee.
Do you notice a difference in that 6 months where you're just drinking tea? Do you notice any difference? Like, because to me, you know, there's all these science studies and these things will pop out and, you know, one day coffee is great for you. The next day coffee is dangerous for you. And like, you know, so like I don't buy into every study I get all the way. I pay attention to my experience. So I'd like to hear your experience with tea versus when you're drinking coffee. And by the way, 3 to 5 cups, not 6 to 20 cups of coffee, right? Like balance is key.
That's the thing. You know, I was, I was like 30 and I went to my doctor and I said, Doc, I'm having heart palpitations. And to me, I don't know anything about that. You know, I'm an idiot. And so I don't know what that means. And he was very unconcerned. He goes, you drink coffee? And I said, I do. And he goes, cut it out or drink less. And I said, really? It's that simple? He's like, yeah, don't worry about them. They're not serious, but drink less coffee. So I would do it. And it would feel like you get used to it. Like the lower caffeine, your body adjusts and it's fine. It's just the taste. Like I love, like you're saying, exploring different coffees. I'm more of a medium roast guy, but sometimes, you know, I'll dabble in the dark roast. I'll do some light roast, you know, but I just love the taste. I love the taste. I drink it black. Overall, it's just, it's more of an experience than it is like I'm just trying to get caffeine in me. It's just, I just love the vibe of it.
Yeah, it's an experience. And it's fun to go check out the different shops. They all have, you know, a different vibe and they're experiencing and of themselves. Coffee is an experience. It's a journey. It's a process. Coffee and baseball. That's what we do, Grant.
I keep meaning to get my hands on Rob Nyer's spreadsheet notebooks of like listing the coffee shops, because I just know you'd get a kick out of it. So I got to make a note to do that. All right. This is episode, what was this? This is episode 11 of The Baseball Barista. Thank you so much for listening. Next time we show up, we'll probably talk about baseball, because that's what we do around here. So thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
I love coffee.